Nobody ever debates the existence of Julius Caesar. But did you know there are more stories, tales, anecdotes, folklore, and remembrance of Santa Claus than there ever has been of Julius Caesar? It is in fact true. Everything you hear in the canon of Santa Claus is true. It is the history of Santa, as told in books, poems, songs, movies, and folklore. And what you're about to hear has never been told before. You're listening to the 42nd episode of Tracing the Path with Dan R. Morris. At the beginning of the 20th century, the rise in spirit in America had drastically increased the number of letters that were being written to Santa Claus. And it skyrocketed even more after 1913 rolled around, when the U.S. Post Office created a new category of mail called parcel post. Parcel post allowed people to mail packages for the first time, which opened the eyes of kids to millions of new things that could be sent and received. And that translated into more letters to Santa. After a visit from Santa Claus himself, the U.S. postmaster understood that Christmastown needed help getting the letters answered. So in 1913, the post office created a program called Operation Santa Claus. They invited people with the spirit of St. Nicholas to read and respond to Dear Santa letters during the month of December. And they invited bids from any company who'd be interested in managing the new project. In New York City, jazz musician and business entrepreneur John Duval Gluck saw the call from the United States Post Service and decided to bid on the project and handle the Dear Santa letters for New York City. And among others, he was selected. It was big news in New York City. The John Duval Gluck Christmas letter story was in the newspapers, and it got people talking. At the same time, the American Boy Scouts group was looking for a civic project the Scouts could work on. Its president, General Edwin McAlpin, saw in the paper that Gluck's Santa Claus Association was awarded the position of answering Santa's mail and was actively looking for volunteers. So McAlpin called Gluck and offered up his Scouts to help. Gluck was more than happy to say yes, and suddenly he had an army of people to help answer Santa's letters. The Scouts were a natural fit for the organization. General McAlpin thought it would be great to share with the world that the Scouts were involved with this civic project and good-hearted program. So he ordered the editor of their magazine, Boy's Life, to write a cover story and asked their illustrator to create a cover image of the Scouts helping Santa. So in the December 1913 issue, their illustrator, a young Norman Rockwell, drew his first Santa Claus cover. It was an image of two Scouts helping Santa Claus get up after having fallen in the snow. By 1915, Gluck announced that his little Santa Claus Association had outgrown the place they had been renting, and he boasted he was going to be building a Santa Claus building in downtown New York, complete with murals of Santa. It was to be 75 feet wide by 100 feet long and feature a 55-foot-tall stained glass Christmas tree. The whole city rallied around this idea, and even Maxfield Parrish, illustrator for L. Frank Baum, would offer up his services to design the building. The idea was more than exciting for the city of New York. Not only did the proposed Santa Claus building make the newspapers in New York City, they also printed news of the first official New York City Christmas tree in Madison Square Park. That story was picked up by all the major newspapers, and in the next 2 years, at least 50 more cities decided to do the same thing. Christmas spirit was growing. But while James Gluck in New York were helping him with the mail situation, Santa had his mind focused on other issues. From 1914 to 1919, the First World War made Christmas delivery difficult for the children of Europe. He had teams of elves working around the clock looking for safe routes to deliver the toys. It was not easy, but the elves reported very few children were missed. Something good did happen during World War I that gave Santa hope, however. When he became Santa, Claus left him with a note about his worry that there was a rise of selfish children and it might be a growing problem. But Santa was seeing something else. It was the soldiers who gave Santa hope. While the soldiers were ultimately loyal to their countries, those same soldiers were also loyal to the spirit of St. Nicholas and to the celebration of Jesus. Pope Benedict XV had made the suggestion that there be a temporary ceasefire of the war for one day to observe Christmas. Christmas Eve, 1914. But the leadership of the warring nations refused. Nevertheless, many of the soldiers in the trenches respected the day enough to stop fighting, informally agreeing to a Christmas truce. And in some cases, soldiers crossed enemy lines to sing carols and even play soccer in the snow with their wartime enemies. It warmed Santa's heart so much to see the spirit of St. Nicholas not squashed by the war. America had soldiers fighting in the war abroad, but also had a war to fight at home. In 1918, America was battling the Spanish flu. Thousands of people had already died, and they didn't exactly know what to do to control it. This was one of the things about Santa's job that worried Mrs. Claus the most. She couldn't let the children down by asking Santa to stay home. She made him some white gloves and told him never to deliver presents without them. But the flu wasn't the only thing putting a damper on Christmas in 1918. The U.S. government was considering canceling gift-giving, and they almost did. But for one reason, the long-term power of the North Pole Express kept Christmas alive. Little A.C. Gilbert had been a rider on the 105th year of the North Pole Express, and it shaped and changed his life forever. He had been an athletic kid, and later on won the pole vault competition in the 1908 Olympics, setting a world record. And then as an adult, while watching the construction of a train bridge from his office window, he thought, building a bridge might be a fun toy for kids. So he cut girders out of cardboard and started to make a cardboard bridge. When it worked, he asked a local toolmaker if he could make all of the cardboard pieces out of steel. And when he was done, A.C. Gilbert had invented the Erector Set. Well, when World War I came around, his Erector Set company was happy to stop making them and to start help making supplies for the war. But when he heard that the government was going to cancel Christmas so everyone could focus on manufacturing for the war effort, he had to take action. He owed it to Santa. He called the Secretary of Commerce for the U.S. and got a meeting set with many of the decision makers. And with him, he brought in a toy submarine, an Erector Set, and a toy train, and showed the officials how these toys made smart thinkers. Thinking, figuring things out, playing together, were all the necessary skills of soldiers. And the government officials agreed. They wouldn't cancel Christmas. A.C. Gilbert would go on to build the largest toy company in the world, and live knowing that he was the man who saved Christmas. But Santa's luck was about to change. Another piece of bad news was on the horizon. Despite A.C. Gilbert saving Christmas, despite the power of the North Pole Express, despite the great magazine covers, there would rise yet another Burgermeister Meisterburger, another Hinkle. Santa and the city of New York had been fooled by a Christmas miser. In 1927, the city of New York's Public Welfare Commissioner got a tip that not all was okay with John Duval Gluck's Christmas Letter organization. He had been raising money from all over New York in the name of raising postage money for the cause. But instead of buying postage, he used it only for himself. And worse yet, he used the scouts to answer and respond to some of the Christmas letters as a way to keep his activities public while he threw the bulk of the letters in the trash. Knowing how important the project was, the post office got rid of Gluck and brought Operation Santa Claus in-house to manage the letters themselves. They didn't want there to be a chance for another Burgermeister to rise. With Gluck out of the way and the Dear Santa letters under control again, Santa was sure his mail problem was finally over. He couldn't remember the last time he could just sit and relax and breathe. All was quiet for a few years, but the security of Christmastown was nagging on Elf Dooley's conscience. At one point, some gold prospectors had brought very large equipment near Christmastown, almost exposing it. And the myth that a fantastic Christmas tree, originated by the sailors of Riga, Latvia long ago, was starting to pique people's interest in maybe exploring the forests and mountains of Finland. And a devilish character named Jack Skellington had magically appeared in Christmastown at one point. Elf Dooley brought his worries to Santa. Santa was so proud of Elf Dooley and his parental nature of wanting to protect Christmastown, he officially awarded Elf Dooley the title of Papa Elf. The new Papa Elf and Santa Claus really needed to focus on building a new Santa's village and leaving Christmastown behind, perhaps for Claus to retire, whom everyone now referred to as Grand Santa. Santa's village would need to be big enough to handle more unexpected growth, including a very robust mail center. When they started planning it out, they decided they would build an elf city right next to the toy factories, where the elves could live and play and enjoy life without being around work all the time. They planned an elf-yourself theater, an elf bowling alley, a Hermes dental clinic, and a gondola to carry elves across the city, and a Christmas Express train to take them back to Santa's village. And Santa brought in some of the Keeblers from the outpost to take over the baking, which is the second job of elves, if you recall. And they not only built a cookie factory, but also opened the Pancake Palace, so the elves could get their daily requirement of candy, candy canes, candy corn, and syrup. They made sure to choose a place for Christmas Village that was near Mount Korvententori, but also gave them access to Lake Notozero in the Murmansk Oblast section of Russia, to give them access to the Barents Sea, so friends like Mr. Narwhal could visit. And being above the Arctic Circle, it would remain cold enough for Frosty the Snowman and Hocus Pocus, Topper the Penguin, Balbo the Polar Bear, and Bumble. They could all live there all year long. And all the extra reindeer that were pasturing in Christmastown, like Bramble, Heather, Windswept, Lichen, Snowball, Crag, Twilight, Elliot, and Tundra. When Santa's village was complete, and the North Pole Express was connected to the new and improved Jingle Bell Square, Santa was relieved. His most important task was done, and he could rest again. Across the pond in America, it made Santa and the elves so happy to see the spirit still rising like a rocket. Santa had not been present when the spirit of St. Nicholas had flourished like wildfire in Europe, so he was happy to be part of this. Making national news, U.S. President Calvin Coolidge had just lit the first national tree in 1923, and they were even happier to see Christmas trees made out of goose feathers start popping up in department stores, giving people who were far from tree farms a chance to have their own Christmas tree. It seemed like there was no end to the creativity and celebrating the spirit of St. Nicholas. In 1924, with the World War I behind them, all the soldiers home, and peace in their future, the biggest department store in New York City, Macy's, created a Thanksgiving parade and featured their store Santa Claus at the end of the parade, ushering in December and the spirit of St. Nicholas. Santa could not believe America made him the great focus. It seemed like New York City would become the headquarters for America's spirit for years to come. With Santa, an exploratory trip to America was long overdue. But the U.S. stock market crash in 1929 began a long depression around the world, and he felt his trip needed to be delayed a bit longer while they figured out ways to be helpful. But America warmed Santa's heart that Christmas. Even though few had extra money to spend and all were truly struggling, kids all over America had left him cookies, milk, and carrots by the Christmas tree. The parents of America still wanted to show their respect to the spirit of St. Nicholas. They weren't going to let the Depression get in the way. The Great Depression affected companies, too. Without extra money to spend, companies like Coca-Cola suffered. And they really suffered in the winter months because they had positioned themselves as a summer drink, and now needed to change that, or they might not survive the next few years. In 1931, 2 years into the Depression, Coca-Cola hired a firm to help come up with a winter campaign. Their idea was to put Coca-Cola in the hands of Santa Claus. All they needed was an artist, and they found one in Michigan, Haddon Sundblom, whose parents actually lived in Finland, just south of Rovaniemi. Haddon was hired to illustrate the campaign. He used Clement Clark Moore's description of Santa in his poem, A Visit from St. Nicholas, to form his own idea, the likes of which were so fantastic and real, you'd think Haddon had sat down with the man himself. Even though they were a commercial for Coca-Cola, and no one had asked Santa for permission, Mrs. Claus loved Sundblom's pictures. She loved them so much, she hung them all around Santa's village. Plus, Haddon was basically one of the local kids, originally being from Rovaniemi. Everyone was proud he had produced the drawings. Sundblom's images were everywhere, and grew the spirit of St. Nicholas even more. But Haddon's Coca-Cola Santa art was soon to be set aside. The North Pole Express miracle would happen again. This time, it was little Jimmy Gillespie. Jimmy had 8 brothers and sisters, but he was the only one who woke when the train came. That was in 1897, the 109th running of the North Pole Express. When he grew up, all he wanted to do was make people smile, like the elves had done for him. He'd write songs about things that happened in his life and would entertain crowds by singing them. He found great success with this skill and wrote songs for some of the most famous people of the time, like Louis Armstrong, Dean Martin, and Frank Sinatra. One day in 1934, he was inspired by the Christmas spirit to write a Christmas song. The first thing that came to mind was, "He knows if you've been bad or good, so be good for goodness sake," a phrase he'd heard from the elves that Christmas Eve night. He brought the lyrics to his writing partner, John Coutts, and in 20 minutes, they had a song. His publisher thought the song sounded like a kid's song and offered it to Eddie Cantor to play on his radio station. And it was an instant hit. In less than 30 days before Christmas, over 400,000 copies of the sheet music for Santa Claus Is Coming to Town had been ordered, and Santa's Village had another North Pole Express success story. And then the following year would surprise Santa again. 1939 would be another great year for Santa's Village. Another one of the North Pole Express riders would make a huge impact on the world. Little Bobby May had been a rider in 1914, the 126th running of the North Pole Express. He was small, quiet, and respectful, but not altogether memorable. He grew up to love advertising, starting first in the copywriting department at Macy's, and then at Gimbel's, and then at Montgomery Ward's. Montgomery Ward was not one of the stores to have people dressed up like Santa Claus inside, but instead offered kids a free Christmas coloring book every year. But in 1939, Disney released the short film Ferdinand the Bull, which was a big hit, and Montgomery Ward wanted to piggyback on that feeling and asked the advertising department if they'd write an animal story for Christmas instead of doing a coloring book. Bob May got the job. Well, Bob's wife was sick with cancer, and he was looking for ways to connect with his daughter. Writing a children's book for Christmas would be perfect, as he could write it with her, and they could read it and tweak it together. He wanted the story to make his daughter smile and give her hope. As a kid, he was always an outcast, being so small, so he wanted the story to be about an outcast animal. And when it was finished, Bob had read it to his daughter every night for 4 months. She loved it, and Montgomery Ward loved the story of the reindeer with the red nose, and handed out 2.4 million copies in 1939 to shoppers. Sadly, soon thereafter, the world would be plunged into World War II, and paper rationing would prevent more printing of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer story. It also meant more tough years for Santa. Making the toy run in Europe would be difficult again, and this time around, there would be no Christmas truce. Plus, many governments enacted rationing. In the U.S., citizens were only allowed to purchase small amounts of high-demand products like sugar, meat, tea, and butter, making it hard to make Christmas cookies and other seasonal treats. Since most of the materials needed to make ornaments were being rationed, people started making homemade ornaments again, with paper, cloth, and natural materials like pine cones. Feeling nostalgic and missing home, or missing their soldiers abroad, Bing Crosby's I'll Be Home for Christmas and White Christmas topped the charts, as well as Judy Garland's Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. And with the men at war, women not only took on the role of factory worker, epitomized in the Rosie the River campaigns, but also took on the role of department store Santa Claus. In Iceland, one thing that wasn't rationed was paper products. And because of that, Icelanders gave books as Christmas gifts and created a sort of unofficial holiday called Jólabókaflóð, or Christmas Book Flood. Every Christmas Eve to this day, you'll find Icelanders huddled by the fire with a hot cup of cocoa, reading books. When the war was over and the world was experiencing post-war excitement, it was finally time. Santa took his first off-season trek to New York City. He wanted to walk the streets and meet the people, to find out more about what made them excited about Christmas. Everywhere he went, department stores, restaurants, drinks, advertisements, and books featured his likeness. And he finally got to see the Coca-Cola advertisements in real life that everyone had said were so beautiful. He was excited to see images of pure happiness. He felt the world was starting to understand the spirit of St. Nicholas. Walking around New York City made him beam with pride. However, seeing the Salvation Army Santas ringing their bells in every corner, Santa had mixed feelings about seeing people dressed as him. While most of them seemed perfectly professional, one of the first fellows he met was the man scheduled to play Santa in the Macy's Day Parade. Santa was dismayed to see this man was drunk and not fit for the role. He was disgraced and immediately informed the parade manager of the debacle. And then, without a Santa to actually fill in, he found himself volunteering to be on top of the float, anchoring that Macy's Day Parade he's always been so proud of. If you were watching the Macy's Day Parade on Thanksgiving in 1947, you had a rare glimpse at Santa Claus himself. And he did meet a young kid that day who loved donning the Santa suit. When Santa asked him why he liked to dress up like Santa Claus, the young kid said, "I love seeing the look on the kids' faces when they talk to me and I give them a candy cane. It makes me feel important inside." And all at once, Santa understood the true power of the red suit. Macy's, on the other hand, knew full well the power. Not knowing who he was, but thinking he did such a wonderful job, Macy asked the man they knew as Kris Kringle if he would be the Santa in their store as well. Curious and hopeful, he agreed. And that's when he got his first taste of the bad side of Christmas. The day after Thanksgiving, people from all over rushed into the city to shop. Thousands of people inside Macy's and other stores fighting for toys and gifts. The exact opposite idea of St. Nicholas. It was a nightmare for the police, and they dubbed it Black Friday. Santa was more than dismayed by all the greedy capitalism, for sure. He was even more sad to find out that genuine kindness was not expected by the people he interacted with. His kindness actually gave Macy's a new reputation in his short stint as their Santa. Instead of directing children to the Macy's toy department, he listened to the children and wished them a Merry Christmas. And if a parent was dismayed that the gift they wanted to buy for their child was not there, Santa would tell them which other store they could go to get it. Macy's was not used to this kind of kindness and wasn't sure whether to discipline him for not directing them to the toy department or to thank him for making the customers happy. After Thanksgiving and Black Friday, he really wanted to add Christmas spirit to the season and decided to tell Macy's that he was the real Santa. But they didn't believe him and started to resent him for it. One thing led to another, and for the first time since the Yes, Virginia essay, Santa's truth was being questioned. But this time, in an American court of law. The story that Santa Claus was on trial to prove who he was made the newspapers, and luckily caught the eyes of the U.S. Post Office. Without having a complete solution for the loss of James Gluck, hundreds of Santa letters in New York City were just sitting in a dead letter office. But now with Santa right down the street at the courthouse, the post office thought it would be best to deliver all those letters directly to him, while he was in court. The judge was so taken aback by the thousands of letters written to Santa, and then delivered to him by an official office of the U.S. government, he declared that this man, Kris Kringle, to be the real Santa Claus. And the world got a shot of Christmas spirit again. And for the post office, this new publicity led to more people being interested in helping Operation Santa Claus, and the program renewed with fervor. But before he left New York City, he thought he'd have Mrs. Claus come visit for a few days. He wanted to show her all the sights she'd only heard about. They had pizza at Ray's, went to the top of the Empire State Building, and saw the Statue of Liberty. And Mrs. Claus's favorite part was seeing the beautiful Christmas window displays stores like Macy's and Saks Fifth Avenue had put together. Window displays had become huge tourist destinations. In fact, the store Bonwit Teller regularly hired artists like Salvador Dali and Andy Warhol to design their windows. He really wanted her to see the beauty of New York City. Unfortunately, they had to cut their trip short. When Santa and Mrs. Claus went for a walk through Central Park, they found themselves in a restricted area near a pond and were quickly and rudely ushered away by the Central Park Rangers. Angry, he vowed to put them on the naughty list. And now, with paper rationing over, Bob May wanted to publish Rudolph again, but Montgomery Ward owned the rights. Miraculously, and in the full spirit of St. Nicholas, Montgomery Ward gave all the rights back to Bob, free of charge, out of pure goodness. So Bob found a publisher. He recorded an audio version of the book and convinced his brother-in-law, Johnny Marks, to turn it into a song. And in 1949, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, The Song, was released as a single by Gene Autry. It was an instant phenomenal success and became the number two most popular Christmas song ever, after White Christmas. Well, the North Pole was beside itself. Never had anything been as powerful as this song. School children were singing it, commercials were playing it, every kid taking piano lessons was learning it. It was a Christmas spirit phenomenon. Santa and Mrs. Claus could only count their blessings that things like this happened on their behalf. One night, he and Mrs. Claus sat around the fireplace, reflecting on the year's trips. They had loved their time in New York City so much, they decided to make it a tradition, and to make more public visits. So they decided they'd start doing 7 official public visits per year. They would spend time at the North Pole Village in Fairbanks, Alaska. They also decided that the Winter Yule Festival in Norway, which was a very popular Christmas destination, would be a great place to stop. And they'd be remiss not making a trip to the home of St. Nicholas in Myra, Turkey. The Hong Kong Winterfest was great. The easiest destination for them would also be the most fun, because they could bring the reindeer to the Sami Festival in Rovaniemi, Finland. And of course, he wanted to be the Santa in Macy's Day Parade many more times. And Mrs. Claus added she wanted to surprise one extra town a year with a visit, perhaps to a shopping mall, to meet the kids. Santa loved this idea, but suggested that maybe this plan be left for the next Santa Claus. Maybe it was time to settle down and hand over the reins. Much was going to need to be accomplished. The world in 1950 was quite different than the world when they had started, and the speed of change was just getting faster. In the next episode of The Canon of Santa Claus, a human, for the first time, makes it to Santa's village. A Grinch changes hearts. The American military gets involved in helping Santa, and a bicycle puts the spirit of St. Nicholas back in Christmas Village. But before we move on, let's look at the stories that hit the cutting room floor. According to J.R.R. Tolkien, in his Father Christmas Letters, the Clift House is the original location of Santa and the elves. In episode 1 of The Canon of Santa Claus, it's the hidden city that Nicholas and Anya are taken to. Because they were taken during a snowstorm, they didn't see the sign that said, "Welcome to Clift House." The original Clift House grows to eventually become Santa's Village. Norman Rockwell created the art for the cover of the Saturday Evening Post for what seemed like decades. His Christmas covers live on and are the most iconic images of Santa. In his book, The Santa Claus Man, Alex Palmer wrote about America's Christmas bad guy, John Duval Gluck. And in the end, despite all his evil, Gluck was never punished or imprisoned. After writing the Rudolph song, Johnny Marks went on to write Rockin' Around the Christmas Tree, Holly Jolly Christmas, Silver and Gold, and Run Rudolph Run. In 1937, Charles W. Howard, a farmer in Albion, New York, established a Santa school in direct response to his displeasure with seeing other Santas in frayed suits and cheap beards, and a shockingly inadequate knowledge of reindeer. He decided that he could start a school to make a better Santa. The first class consisted of three men, including a welder from New Jersey, his friend, and a neighbor. After the real Santa Claus was the Macy's Day Thanksgiving Parade Santa in 1947, he told Macy's the only person he would approve as the Macy's Santa going forward was Charles Howard. And from 1948 to 1965, Charles Howard served that role. Robert May, author of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, had a sister, Evelyn. Evelyn May is the grandmother of Stephen D. Levitt, author of the best-selling book, Freakonomics. In World War II, German soldiers didn't hear American Christmas music, but were hearing a familiar tune nonetheless. Morgen kommt der Weihnachtsmann. Translated into English, it is Santa's Coming Tomorrow. While Americans probably didn't understand the lyrics of the song they were hearing on the radio, they certainly knew the tune. It was sung to Twinkle Twinkle Little Star. The 2020 Dana Nachman documentary Dear Santa is about the Operation Santa Claus the post office manages in the United States. You will be amazed at the lengths volunteers go to fulfill the wishes of children everywhere. You've been listening to the 42nd episode of Tracing the Path with Dan R. Morris. Stay tuned for Chapter 6 of The Canon of Santa Claus.